This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Donald Trump continues to wage war over athletes' right to protest during the national anthem. Earlier this month, he suggested that instead of protesting, NFL players should give him the names of people who they think are unfairly treated by the justice system. The players responded.
Mr. President, we should pardon those who have life without parole for nonviolent offenses who have served a large portion of their time.
That's Malcolm Jenkins, a player for the Philadelphia Eagles, one of four current and former NFL players who penned a New York Times op-ed in response to Trump, and one of the many topics we'll talk about on this installment of Back Channel, our recurring series connecting culture and context. Later, we'll review two new artistic meditations on marriage, Beyoncé and Jay-Z's joint album, Everything Is Love, and a new show from Mara Brock-Akil, the creator of Girlfriends and Being Mary Jane. Plus, Nina Simone's childhood home in Tryon is designated a national treasure. Joining me for all that and more are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie is a filmmaker and adjunct professor. Welcome back, Natalie.
Thank you, Frank.
Mark Anthony Neal is chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. He's an author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Mark, welcome
back. Hey, what's
back.
Up, Frank? How you doing?
Very good. So Donald Trump asks NFL players who are committed to protesting to instead suggest people for him to pardon. And this comes, of course, as the NFL announced a new policy that will require players to stand for the national anthem on the field or wait in the locker room. Four current and former players pen a response in the New York Times. They make it an op-ed in the Times. So let's start with a clip from two of the co-authors who are talking in an interview on CNN.
All of us are affected by these issues. You talk about police brutality. I'm currently dealing with that situation in my family. I had a cousin who was killed by an officer after he broke down on the side of the road. Mm-hmm. So these are real issues that we're dealing with. These are not things that are made up by players, but it's things that we see every day in our communities with our families. So it's a conversation that we feel like needs to be had.
We've said it over and over again that we are people who love this country. We have friends that are in military, family that's in the military. The reason why we stand up and we speak in sometimes situations where it's not popular is that we want this country to be all that she can be.
And that's former NFL player Anquan Boldin and New Orleans Saints Benjamin Watson talking to Don Lemon on CNN. They are two of the four players who authored a New York Times op-ed in response to Donald Trump. So, Natalie, what's your response to all of this?
When I first saw a headline about Trump wanting NFL players to recommend people to pardon, you know, I just felt like, you know, nuance is so lost on this president, because that's not really what NFL players have been kneeling about. Mm-hmm. He thinks in these broad terms that they have a problem with the criminal justice system. Okay, so tell me who to pardon and I'll think about it, right? But what he does not get is that they're exercising their First Amendment rights. That's number one. But number two, you know, it's more specific. What they're talking about, it's micro and macro, because what they're talking about is the injustices that happen to Black people every day, especially at the hands of police, but then also the larger issue of how broken the criminal justice system is when it deals with these cases where unarmed Black people are killed, but then, you know, the fact that no one is held accountable for these incidents. So I just think that it's just par for the course. It's just more, is another hit and another example of this president not understanding. And I think it's that he just doesn't care to really put his mind to what these players are trying to, you know, bring to our attention.
And Mark, it's an old school form that we're talking about in terms of writing an op-ed in the New York Times. What about that format?
You know, it's wonderful because, again, it dispenses with this idea of the dumb jock. And their whole engagement around Black Lives Matter and protesting police brutality really challenges our perception that they are not thinkers and they're not strategic in their thinking and what have you. So the fact that they chose the New York Times op-ed, I think, is absolutely brilliant, right? It's that kind of space that is so respectful, you know, for so many folks. But it's also, you know, addressing a president who's driven by news cycles.
That's right.
Who his own pardonability is on the one hand connected to ego, but it's also doing a certain kind of dog whistle work around what's happening politically with him at this moment. I mean, you think about his two earlier most well-known pardons, you know, Crazy Joe Sheriff, you know, from out west, from Arizona, Scooter Libby, you know, in terms of the Bush administration, right? And so all of these pardons, particularly because we never talk about presidential pardons in the second year of a presidential term, right? It's always at the end of the cycle, right? Who can I get out before, you know, I'm gone? All of this are signals to folks in terms of the kind of choices or choices they're not making in terms of the investigation of his own White House and Russian collusion. So it really has nothing to do with actually addressing these kinds of issues. And they called him on it. It's like, because in his mind, okay, you know, they're protesting because there's some black person who got arrested who they didn't think needed to be arrested. That's not what the protests are about.
No, and in a way it underscores the problem because it's more about, in his case, the royal privilege of pardon, right? I mean, I'm the white guy in the White House. Come to me if you have a problem, not through the democratic process to change the system.
Kim Kardashian knew to come through me.
Right, she bowed down. Right.
Follow her lead.
Yeah.
So what effect do you think this has had? I mean, again, we're just talking about siloed politics, but I mean, in terms of the impact it has, again, using that format, going to the New York Times, is this a way of sort of reinforcing the faithful on both sides, or does this have some crossover effect?
I mean, that's a good question. I'm not sure that I feel like, you know, there is a swath of Trump supporters of that base who are just unpersuadable. It doesn't matter what happens, what's said, what the argument is. They're just not going to be swayed. I think that there are people who are closer to the center who may be, you know, actually who I think will respect and probably even understand what's really at the heart of the protest by NFL players and even in the larger scheme of things, you know, by Black Lives Matter activists. But, you know, when it comes to like actually changing people's minds and really fostering an understanding of what needs to be done and how these things actually systemically need to be addressed, I'm not sure that it's going to make that big of an impact.
And maybe we're all making a mistake, or maybe I make a mistake by asking what impact is this thing going to have on that? Because if we look at the broader picture and we can switch gears here and talk about that, what's going on nationally, particularly if we look at what's happening in these primaries, there's some kind of movement going on. I mean, let's take a look at the swell of women in color, women of color running for office in 2018. Some big wins, including just this week, 28-year-old Latina Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez defeating an incumbent congressman, a high-ranking Democrat. And earlier this year, Stacey Abrams becomes the first black woman, a major party nominee for governor. And let's listen to her clip talking about running for governor in the state of Georgia.
So why were people saying they don't believe that you qualify to even run?
They don't think I'm viable because I am a black woman with natural hair and no husband. I know you all recently had Senator Harris on, and she and I had an amazing time. She was down here last week helping me with my campaign, and you know, we don't look like what people are used to, and that can be frightening, but it's also exciting. It's an opportunity for young people. I met a young woman at a restaurant recently, and she actually nearly got sent home early because she stopped waiting on her other patrons to come and talk to me. But she was a political science major at Clark Atlanta, and she said she had never seen a woman who looked like her with natural hair who could stand to be in one of the highest offices in the land, and that inspired her.
Stacey Abrams on a radio show, The Breakfast Club. Mark?
It's so important. You know, Melissa Harris Perry talks about this all the time. The most loyal constituency within the Democratic Party is black women. And they've never had access to dictating platforms, dictating policies. You don't see them in terms of the ranks of folks who are being elected. This is an important shift. And whether or not some of these campaigns are successful or not, the fact that when you listen to Stacey Abrams and she talks about meeting this young black woman who had never seen someone like her, for that young woman, that is a possibility for her going forward,
right?
It's a possibility for my 15-year-old looking at all of this play. So even if this stuff doesn't end up as a W, this is an important moment in terms of American politics.
Absolutely, because the precedent has been set, right? And now, just like with President Obama, scores, hundreds of millions of young black kids now imagine that, wow, this is possible for me because I've seen someone like, you know, there are a lot, there's a whole generation of black kids who grew up with a black president. Mm-hmm. And so that will always have an impact on them. And I think the same significance is implanted in this moment when there are so many women of color running and actually viable and may end up in Congress.
On the state of things today, my guests are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark is the chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke. Natalie's a filmmaker and adjunct professor. Just ahead, we're going to talk about Nina Simone's childhood home in Tryon, North Carolina, more about politics in North Carolina and the changing trends, particularly on the left. All of that on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. It's Back Channel Today, our recurring series connecting culture and context with popular culture experts Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. And we turn now to the legacy of Nina Simone, pianist, singer, and activist who was once dubbed the High Priestess of Soul. But she came from very humble roots, born Eunice Wayman in a three-room home in the small North Carolina town of Tryon, North Carolina, a home recently designated a national treasure. And how that came to be, Mark, is a story in and of itself.
Four artists who came together and felt the need to protect this legacy of this home and this particular artist. It's an incredible story, right? And it's there's some irony to it that it's, you know, these kind of working visual artists who don't necessarily have access to a lot of capital. There are any number of well-known black celebrities who could have done the same thing years ago. But I also think it speaks to protecting the house in terms of what it meant in terms of the artistic value of it, right? That it's not just to be a museum piece, but for us to think about it in terms of the artistic contribution of the person who lived there.
New York artist, nonetheless. I mean, which is to say, not even from North Carolina,
from
right?
North Carolina,
I mean, it's not even Southern necessarily, but see the artistic value in this. And what's interesting is the homes of a lot of other creative artists who have been, who are memorialized in one way or another, those homes have not been preserved. So this is kind of a rare opportunity to save the place where she was from, to make it a kind of more than a monument, but a place where art can be done.
Yeah, and I think that it's really apt that this is Nina Simone's house that is being highlighted and preserved in this way because, you know, number one, of course, she is from North Carolina. So there is something about these quote-unquote humble beginnings, you know, that I think has the potential to inspire and to also underscore just how important she was. I mean, this little girl, this little black girl who, you know, from things that, you know, you can read about Nina Simone and see in documentaries about her, you know, she was not considered attractive. I mean, she was talented. She was, I think, actually considered
no, she was a
brilliant.
Prodigy.
Yeah,
yeah,
a prodigy.
She was definitely. Yeah.
And on piano. But, you know, like the prospects for a young black girl of, like Nina Simone at the time that she was born to become this icon, you know, there's something to be said about her trajectory. And I think the fact that these artists, and they're all black artists, I believe, you know, are, you know, that they see that and they want to promote that, I think is really important because it shows that they recognize how important her work and her contributions.
Yeah, Adam Pendleton is one of those artists and he talked about just that.
It was a new home for them. When they lived here, it was actually, you know, it was a house on a hill. I think it's important when you look at this, that this was about opportunity. This was about really putting your roots down somewhere in a place that you thought was good. There was clearly a sense of pride, no? That they had this home and this was their family.
Yeah, Adam Pendleton, a conceptual artist who is one of the four artists who banded together to buy Nina Simone's childhood home in Tryon, North Carolina, which has since become a national treasure. And Mark, I think that's something important, too. We'll look at a 660-foot square-foot home there in the mountains and call it humble. But I think what Adam said is important in terms of what Natalie was saying.
For black middle-class families that period of time, actually just to have a home in that sense where you had space and children could have their own bedrooms and things like that, that was particularly important. You know, the reclaiming of Nina Simone is really interesting to me. You know, when Natalie talks about her trajectory, I think about Baldwin in the same way. You have these two pivotal figures for the 1960s who are being reclaimed by a new generation. And I'm wondering where that's going. Because even when we recover Nina Simone, folks don't talk much about Nina Simone's music, right? Mm. And it's a massive body of work that folks don't seem to have a feel for. Nor do we necessarily talk about her politics in ways that they need to talk about. It's the same case with Baldwin. Like, Baldwin's been recovered, but outside of The Fire Next Time, we don't really talk about, you know, how much of that work is. So I'm wondering where this is going, right? Is this a kind of starting point for thinking about a new, younger generation of folks kind of reclaiming their legacies? I'm concerned about whether or not, say, the work of Nina Simone actually gets included in building upon this legacy going forward.
Well, what would that be? Because I have not seen a story about her. And again, I don't know if you're talking about your students who are coming to you who may have had no knowledge of her, but there's not a story that doesn't include her rendition and her creation of the song Mississippi GD.
Or Young, Gifted, and Black.
Mm-hmm.
And
so
we get
Black,
we get those particular points, but this is a woman who recorded from 1957 until literally almost till her death. And we only talk about those two songs, right? Yeah. And her career was so much more. You know, as a woman, this is the 1960s recording industry. She's dropping five albums a year. Right? So, I mean, it literally is a massive body of work that we're not really talking about.
Yeah. I just think that, you know, Nina Simone is complicated. There's a lot to wrap your head around in terms of what she contributed, because as Mark is saying, you know, there is this breadth of her work. So she was this contribution musically is very significant. But then what she did with her music to contribute to civil rights, to the civil rights movement, and her politics, which were radical, really, at the time that she was at her peak, you know, all of that is really important. So it's interesting to consider what Mark is suggesting. You know, how is this all going to sort of pan out? Where is this going? And will we really reckon with who Nina Simone was at her core and how that manifested?
Well, it's interesting because we're going to talk about some television series and music that is current today that seems to be bringing more nuance into these conversations. So maybe in that context, you know, it's something else to consider. But for Nina Simone herself, she was aware of the struggle very early on. Nina Simone's only surviving sister, Frances Wayman Fox, was at the designation ceremony last week. And she told a story about the first time she saw Nina take the stand for civil rights. She was 10 years old, and she wasn't taking the stand. She was taking a piano stool for civil rights. And here's her sister's rendition of that story.
Our parents were sitting up front, and they were moved to the back. Blacks couldn't sit up front. And she refused to play if her parents couldn't be up on that front row.
There it is. Nina Simone's sister, Frances Wayman Wayman Fox, who's her only surviving sister, and she's talking about a piano recital that Nina Simone did for her parents at, I believe, the age of 10. She was 10 years old at the time. Well, let's do this now and make this turn to Beyoncé and Jay-Z's new album, Everything Is Love. It's the third installment in their series of albums about their marriage. Let's hear a little clip.
Yeah. I'm good on any MLK Boulevard. I'm good on any MLK Boulevard. See my vision with a tech, the Malcolm X. Haters dreading my effect, they want that DOS effect.
Get your hands up high like a phosphorus. Let me see them up high, this is not a test. Yes, put them up, this is not a test. Put your hands where I can see them, what's a phosphorus? With your curls, your lips, there are by mips. Gotta hop into my jeans like I hop into my whim, yeah. Hopping in a hoodie like hello. Come up by that pretty mother like hello.
shoot the nose off my pharaoh. Yeah.
It's a clip from Black Effect from the new Jay-Z and Beyonce joint album, Everything is Love. I'm here with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel, Episode 3 in the saga of their marriage.
Yeah. I was just thinking as we were listening to Black Effect that I love the fact that there are little references back to 444 at least, and Lemonade. So, you know, I've read reviews that say that love, Everything is Love is like the third part of this triptych. And I think that, you know, it's part of what I think is brilliant about Beyonce and Jay-Z. Like, I know, I get all the, you know, the fact that they know what they're doing. They are making music that is commercially viable. They have this new On the Run tour. You know, there's a lot going on. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like, I don't think we can take away from them the fact that they are artistically doing some things that, like, on a level that can't really be rivaled. And I think that the way that they have interwoven, you know, their talents together on this album is just incredible. I'm like, I'm still processing, you know, what I'm hearing, but I love every single track on this album. I think it's a beautiful way to kind of bring together Lemonade and 444 and close it out.
Mark?
You think about the artists who came before them that we could compare them to, Marvin Gaye, Tammy Terrell, though they weren't romantically linked. Specifically, Nick Ashford and Valerie Simpson. But Valerie Simpson and Nick Ashford never had access to the wide platform that Jay-Z and Beyonce do. And the thing that's always so brilliant about both of their work together now and individually is the way that they can function on this highest level and still have a little something back for the hood. So when Jay-Z goes, I'm good in every MLK Boulevard,
right,
there are 3 million white folks who have no idea
what that means.
And every black person in America knows exactly what that means.
That's
that
right.
When I go back to the hood, I'm good.
That's right.
Because the only place you're going to find an MLK Boulevard
is
in the hood.
That's right.
What about this, though, artistically? Is this because of the story, do you think, or is there something going on with the two of them that actually distinguishes them as royalty and high art? In other words, if they didn't have the story, they're really a married couple, they're actually taking us inside their marriage, and we all want to know more about that. Without that story, is this still a great album?
You know, what I find about this album, it's not Lemonade.
Mm-hmm.
It's not 444. It's the album that they had to do to bring closure, and they didn't force it. Right? They let it come naturally. They let it be what it was going to be. One of the criticisms I always had at Michael Jackson, I always thought Michael Jackson's career trajectory would have been so much different if he'd just been willing to just do another album instead of doing another Thriller.
Mm-hmm.
Right, if he'd just gone in the studio and did another album, right, you know, without the pressure of I got to do something bigger than Thrill. So they made an album that was not about we got to over, you know, we got to go further than Lemonade and further than 444. We're just going to make an album together that feels organic to us.
And it does feel organic, and I think that's part of why it's so appealing, because it does not feel like they are forcing anything. It doesn't feel contrived. It actually feels like they had a lot of fun. You know, that they enjoyed working together, that they enjoyed collaborating with the producers that, you know, that are featured on this album, and that you know, that they're weaving their lived experiences with their art in a really, as Mark said, organic way. It's very authentic. That's what it feels like to me. And it seems to be resonating. I mean, I've read quite a few reviews just trying to figure out, like, you know, what are people saying about this? And I only read one that kind of cast a cynical lens on the album. Everyone else, you know, just applauded it, you know.
Well, the other reviews, the same thing that reviewers are saying that makes this in some ways a turning point is that this album lets Beyonce's skills as a rapper shine more than some of the other joint ventures. Let's hear a clip from Ape Stuff.
Give me my check. Put some respect on my check. Pay me in equity. Pay me in equity. Watch me reverse out of dicks. He got a bad chick. We live in lavish. I get expensive fabrics. I got expensive habits. He wanna go with me. He likes to roll with me. He wanna be with me. He wanna give me that vitamin D. Ice ornaments. Ice style ornaments. You ain't owner this. Don't think they owner this.
a ball, take a top shift. Call my girls and put them all on a spaceship. Hang one night with him, say I'll make you famous. Have you ever seen a stage going ape?
The Ape Stuff from Beyonce and Jay-Z's. That one recorded inside the Louvre. Now, that's interesting, too, the location just for that, for the video, video, right? Video. Yeah, kind of cool. Let's switch gears here. I want to talk about Black Thought's first solo project now. And we'll talk about also working with Ninth Wonder, who you work with, Mark, and who is, of course, we know him very well here in Durham. Tell us a bit about Black Thought, his background as an artist. He starts with the roots in high school, right?
Yeah, you know, he's a fascinating figure. I mean, both his parents came out of Nation of Islam. They both died very early in his life. And so he meets Questlove, you know, going to the art school in Philadelphia, and they create this organization, you know, they create the Roots, you know, who we now know and a global entity in that regard. What's always been fascinating about me about Black Thought, he's been kind of a lunch pail guy in hip hop. Not very flashy. He's not out there. He just comes to work for every album and does his job. And now he's at this moment in his career where he's getting this well-deserved shine, in large part because of this 10-minute freestyle that he did
a few months ago
on the radio. And so I'm happy for him because it also harks back to, you know, one of the things about this album is that there are no hooks. And folks are like, I don't like this. It don't have any hooks. Like, if you go back 20 years to what hip hop was, it wasn't no hooks, right? So there's something really pure about, you know, what he's producing at this point.
You know, one of the things that, like, I am not by any means an expert on hip hop, so I'm just gonna put that out there. But one of the things that I really respect about Black Thought is that he, you know, by all what am I trying to say?
By all measures and all accounts.
Yes, but I mean everyone who I know that is a hip hop head, you know, everyone sees Black Thought as one of the top lyricists. Like even though in spite of what Mark said, you know, that he's a lunch pail guy, he is respected for his skills. And you know, and I think that it certainly showed up in that freestyle that he did. Was it on The Breakfast Club?
Yeah, High 97. Yeah.
Right, but you know, also, you know, Rhapsody has him in a guest spot on her album on Layla's Wisdom.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the name of the track, but you know, he says like she knows what's up, that she has me on her album. Right, and to me, that, and then he has her on his album. And to me, that's, that just kind of confirms this idea that like minds, that, you know, that iron sharpens iron. He recognizes the talent in Rhapsody and vice versa. You know, but that he is so revered, but yet so understated, so behind the scenes, I think it's amazing that this is now the moment when he is really getting shine that's really always kind of been there, but I guess has been sort of understated.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of the music. This one's called Ninth Versus Thought.
I mess around, make a call, get the gat involved. I know people, this is a small world after all. My credit card say it's all world at the mall. My broad looking like she's Cinderella at the ball. Reborn every January like a Capricorn. From downtown, no Ryan Lewis and Macklemore. It's yours truly, I'm Paul Mooney, I'm George Clooney. I'm fully immersed in the craft, bringing awards to me. The bass player said he gon' sue me. I gave a finger to him, the Lord gave a round of applause to me. My soul winning, I've been gold tinning. Cold sinning, scroll pinning, nigga gone till it's no limit. The vision came to me so vivid. My observation wasn't money for the taking, I'ma go and get it. Y'all know my everyday lay no costume. I murk rappers and they can't play no possum. Another studio, but it's the same old outcome. I told my niggas small vicious, baby, we got one. Listen. Scholarship and free dedicated artists would reveal a singularly important thing. Racism was and is not only a mark of ignorance, it was and is a monumental fraud.
That's a clip from Ninth Versus Thought from the new EP, Streams of Thought, Volume 1, Black Thought, produced with Ninth Wonder. Talk about Ninth's contribution to this record.
And, you know, it's an EP, 17 minutes long. Ninth did 4 to 5 tracks, and one of his crew of folks did the fifth one. We're happy for Patrick because this is kind of a level of visibility for him that's really amazing. I mean, you know, Black Thought, given the respect he has in the industry, could have done this with anybody. But he chose Ninth Wonder. And I think that's an important, you know, amount of respect for what Ninth is doing. You know, at the same time, Ninth appears on the Superfly soundtrack of a song with Rick Ross. So, it, you know, it's kind of like his moment at this time. What I love about Black Thought, again, this kind of idea of certain kind of density, right? So there's a song in which he mentions both Kerry James Marshall and Kerry Mae Weems, you know, which is amazing. The artwork for the album was done by Rasheed Johnson, who's one of the four artists who are purchasing the Simone's house, right? So this kind of synchronicity about all of this, I think, is pretty amazing.
Popular culture writ large on Back Channel today. Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown. Just ahead, the new TV series from creator Mara Brock Akil and the second season of Dear White People. That and more just ahead. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal are with me for Back Channel, our recurring series connecting culture and context. Natalie's a filmmaker and adjunct professor. Mark is chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University and author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Next up, a new TV series from Mara Brock Akil. She's known for creating Girlfriends and Mary Jane. In this new show, she brings her own love story to the screen. Natalie, tell us about the premise of the show, Love Is.
Well, basically, it is a show based on Mara and her husband Salim's own love story. And it looks at how they met and how their relationship developed. And without spoiling too much of it, I mean, they really kind of knew fairly early on that they wanted to be together. And so in many ways, you know, they have a fairy tale love story.
Here's the fictive rendition of that meeting on their program.
You're a writer.
Yes. Although I'm not getting paid as, but yes. I am a writer.
You sure about that?
I am positive.
Okay, so you practicing the power of positive thinking.
Yes. I am. You read that book?
No. I think it's easier to pretend that dreaming is for losers.
Huh. Okay. Well, what if you were a loser? What dream would you be chasing?
Directing? Writing, telling our stories?
Well, we have that in common.
It was nice meeting you.
That's a clip from the new show Love Is from creator Mara Brock Akil, based on her relationship with her husband Salim Akil. Show airs on Oprah's network OWN, and I'm here with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel. So another power couple, another you know, creative rendition of their own story in some ways. What about the craft of this, the story itself? If you were watching this and didn't know any of that, Natalie, you still love it?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the writing is incredible. I think that, you know, one of the things that I think is really important about a couple, well, just producers like Mara and Salim Akil, is that they are determined, as we kind of got a glimpse of in this first meeting scene. They're determined to tell our stories, you know, to make Black people visible in a way that we have not been before. And really our interior lives, not what people see, you know, when we're out in public, but what are we going through both internally and within our homes and in our relationships. And, you know, so I really respect that. And I think that they do a really masterful job. I mean, this is Mara's directorial debut. And she also wrote she's the writer. Yeah. She's the chief writer for Love Is. And I just think it's some of her best work because it's so real. Like the premise of these two people meeting and pretty much falling in love immediately feels, you know, you could be kind of cynical and feel like, yeah, whatever. And their best friends, Yasir and Nuri, the characters, their friends are just like, you know, come on, get over yourselves. This is not really happening the way that you think it is. But the way that it's written, you believe it, you know, it's believable. I mean, besides the fact that it really happened, I think it's very well done.
Mark?
You also get the benefit of the wisdom gained from who they were in the 1990s by seeing these adult versions of them.
Yeah.
that are played by other actors. You know, seeing Clark Peters, who so many folks know from The Wire, really cast in a very different kind of role.
Yep.
And there's a kind of freedom in those conversations that you don't hear. They're very honest about the challenges, right? Because, you know, in terms of your Sears character, you know, he's messy. Right. You know, those early days of their relationship, and part of it for her is messy too, but he's really messy, and to be able to own up to what that was, you know, you see him in terms of the trajectory of his life at like a really, really low point, right? And be able to kind of rise from that is a wonderful part of the story.
Absolutely. But, you know, also the fact that there is, in his messiness, Yasir is also very together, because even though he's messy and he there's a lot going wrong and going on in his life, at the same time, he knows what he wants.
Mm-hmm.
He's very clear about who he is, what his purpose is. And so it's a really interesting counterpoint to the messiness.
I want
to
play another clip. And this is a scene where Yasir is standing with his friend outside a furniture store when Nuri walks by.
Yo, yeah. There goes that girl.
What girl?
Light skin, long curly hair.
From Insomnia? Cut off her hair. She clearly don't squat. Damn. Yep. That's her. Light skin, long curly hair. Minus the long curly hair.
You gotta appreciate any woman that's brave enough to cut her hair. But when a light skin woman cuts her hair, it's basically a rejection of a light skin privilege and a public pledge aligning her identity closer to her blackness.
Or she may have just wanted a haircut.
Mia, don't let these men put you in a box or play with your box.
Come on, man.
What? You gotta let them know early, otherwise she'll end up like her mother. Not on my watch.
That's a clip of the new show Love Is from creator Mara Brock Akil, based on her relationship with her husband Salim Akil. Airs on Oprah's OWN network. Mark, does this, well, you comment on that scene. But there's the comment.
Right. You know, just a commentary about how men think about black women and their bodies and their hair, right? And it's the whole idea. Yep. It's like if she cut her hair, she's actually, it's not even just about the light skin privilege, right? It's about the hair that goes along.
Right.
In some ways, it's, the hair is more important than the light skin, you know, at this point in time. The fact that his friend is a single father, right, you know, with a baby mama, and he's trying to do the right thing and also using this example with, you know, with his friend to talk about these dynamics for his, you know, infant baby at this point in time. And Yasir is walking around Los Angeles in his underwear. He's wearing a pair of Calvin Klein underwear, and like everybody knows it.
Right.
He can't afford to wear anything else.
Right. Everything is dirty.
Well, and Mara Brock Akil and her husband Salim Akil, as we said, it's airing on Oprah's network, and they were talking with Oprah about their intentions for this series. Right? And so let's listen to what they were saying in this conversation with Oprah Winfrey.
I hope people can see themselves in it.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? I just hope that they can see themselves and not see this as a blueprint, but see it as permission to sort of have their own relationship and design it the way that it works for them. I think oftentimes people are looking for one blueprint, one way to do something that's successful. And I really believe in relationships, the thing that gets in the way is that, one, we take ownership of each other. Mm. And two, we're living somebody else's life. We try to live somebody else's life. And we don't look at the nuances of the person that we're sitting across from. Mm.
I think if I added anything, what I do want that we deserve love. Mm. I want people to know that you deserve it. Now, in deserving it is work.
Mara Brock Akil, her husband Salim Akil, talking with Oprah about the new show that Mara created called Love Is. Mark, does this answer some of your question you were raising earlier about what happens with Nina Simone's legacy in the millennial age in terms of nuance and a deeper understanding? Is it your sense that in, you know, cultural production these days is focused on nuance?
Oh, nuance. I mean, they're owning the messiness of this, and I think it's important. And you know, I look at what's happening in black popular production, cultural production now. Everything that's happening in the world, we have all these young thinkers and scholars who are describing themselves as Afro-pessimists. And I'm like, you Negroes just don't know how to be happy. right? And so you listen to this conversation with these two, and it's like, deserve love. Right. And that is a radical message to black folks in this moment.
Absolutely.
Right? Not only should you seek it, you deserve it. It's not easy. It's not always fun, but you deserve what this means for our lives.
Right.
And to have a story that's so honest about that, I think it's so critically important for us right now.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I really appreciate that Salim, you know, makes the comment that this is not a blueprint. You know, we want you to, you know, be inspired, but to define your relationship the way that you want to. Make the love that you have be what you need it to be, not based on what you see us doing, but just know that it's possible, you know? And I think that is an important message too, because we, you know, so much is cookie cutter. You know, we look at Jay-Z and Beyonce, we look at Mara and Salim, we look at Angelina and Brad Pitt, even though they're no longer together. But all these celebrity couples, you know, people aspire to be like them, not realizing that, you know, as Mara said, the relationship that you want takes work.
Yeah.
You know, and for Salim and Mara to model not only what's possible, but to remind us that, you know, go get yours because you deserve it. You know, I think that's just incredible. And it's a part of reason why they are so important, you know, in our culture right now.
Well, let's talk about another program now that's airing on the TV, actually a Netflix series, second season of Dear White People. And it comes from creator Justin Simien. He created the 2014 film by the same name, Dear White People. Why don't we start playing a clip that reminds us of what Dear White People is trying to do?
I mean, I think that, like, we are in this age where if a black person says something like Dear White People, the immediate assumption is that it's anti-white. But the truth is that there's a vested interest, frankly, in making us seem more outraged than we are. The truth is that this show is just an honest portrayal of our experiences, of being in a country that we really don't necessarily have a lot of control over how we're viewed in, about how our cultural conversations are packaged. And, you know, that's all it ever is trying to be. And ideally, black folks can watch a show and go, oh my God, totally, that's exactly how it feels. But also, my dear white people, you get to watch a show and go like, oh, that's how it feels? Interesting. And maybe we can you know, do this thing called life together. I don't know.
Justin Simien, the creator of the Netflix show Dear White People on Comedy Central's The Opposition with Jordan Klepper. And I'm here with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal for Back Channel. Remind us of the premise of this show, Mark.
It's set on a college campus, and it's, you know, black students trying to navigate life on a PWI.
Mm-hmm. And let's go to another scene. And actually, I want to talk a little bit more about it before we go to this scene, because it's light, it's comic, and then it takes on some very deep themes. We're going to play a scene here. A scene in which abortion is the topic and it is considered very seriously. Natalie, tell us more about sort of the way the themes are handled in this series.
Well, one of the things that is emerging as sort of a structural approach, I guess, that the Dear White People creators take is that every episode sort of features one of the main characters. And kind of their story is the through line for that episode. So in the scene that you just set up, the character Coco, who is like the aspirational black female character who, you know, absolutely knows why she is at Winchester, knows where she's trying to go, how she's going to get there, and she don't have no problem doing what she needs to do that. She finds herself pregnant, and it takes her back to, you know, her beginnings, because her mom, you know, was essentially a pregnant as a teen. And so she has to deal with, you know, I'm this brilliant black woman on this campus with all these prospects, right? This future ahead of me, you know, that I might have to totally say goodbye to because I don't know how this pregnancy is going to affect my future. So I think it's really well, it's handled very well. It's handled very adeptly. And it's handled with comedy, you know, but the comedy is not cheap. It's very smart. I think the writing is so brilliant. And so that's typical for this series.
Well, let's hear this scene now. This is from episode 4. The character Coco is with her roommate Kelsey talking about her fears over this pregnancy.
What kind of life can I give a child?
Well, Troy could help, right?
Troy Fairbanks, the drug-addled rebel without a cause.
Yeah, him.
I came here to take everything the world denied my mother and dared to deny me. What could I even give to a full human?
You'd be surprised. It can be a relief to not be so focused on yourself, you know? To actually care for something or someone else. At least we're not having this discussion in Texas. Or Kentucky.
Or Missouri.
Or Virginia.
Or Utah.
Or South Dakota.
I really am needed on Capitol Hill.
Desperately.
Having a choice doesn't make that choice any easier to make.
That's a clip from the second season of the Netflix show, Dear White People. Mark Anthony Neal, this next season actually explores what could be a more volatile question, and that is the question of the legacy of this institution.
Oh, absolutely. The one thing I always liked about the series is that it goes where the film couldn't. I always thought the film was a little limited, and not in a good way. The series allows it to explore all these kind of nuances. You know, the point that Natalie made about giving each individual character a way as an inroad to understand the institution. And all of these PWIs, as they relate to this issue of race, are having to deal with these legacies are going to mean. You know, the same way the Duke is looking at the Allen Building takeover 49 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. And wondering, you know, what does that mean to the legacy of the institution? You know, Dear White People is helping us get a better understanding of that, those kind of realities on the ground. Mm-hmm.
We have spent another fabulous hour taking a look at popular culture on the American scene with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark is the chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University and author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Natalie's a filmmaker and an adjunct professor, and you can find out more about them and their work at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you both.
Thank
you,
Frank.
Thank you so much, and thank you for listening to The State of Things, which is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.